President Biden announced a plan yesterday to reduce violent crime in cities around the country. Parts of that plan include stricter enforcement of gun dealer laws, strike forces aimed at illegal gun trafficking, and allowing cities to use federal relief funds on law enforcement and violence prevention programs. It comes after a spike in gun violence in many communities last year. The increase is most noticeable in major cities, but many suburban and rural communities have seen increased gun violence as well. According to some estimates, homicides went up about 30% in 2020 and are still on the rise. Last year, for example, Milwaukee saw a record 189 homicides. So far this year, 89 people have been killed, ahead of last year's pace. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on this increase in homicides and on the crime prevention efforts we just heard about from the White House this week? Have you or your community been affected by gun violence? What would make a difference? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Joseph Richardson is chair of the African American Studies Department at the University of Maryland. His research focuses on gun violence, and he's the executive director of the Transformative Research and Applied Violence Intervention Lab. Joe, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
I know there's not necessarily easy answers out there when we see this sort of nationwide rise in homicides, but having watched this issue so closely over the years, Joe, what kind of things come into your head when you think about why these numbers are going up?
There's several reasons why I think the numbers are going up, but they, in many cities, the numbers have been going up pre-COVID. So, for example, if you take, for example, Baltimore, Maryland, which has historically had considerably high homicide rates, homicide rate has been going up since 2015. And then in other cities such as Philadelphia, you've also found significant increases in homicides that were going up pre-COVID as well. But as you have articulated, in 2020, many U.S. cities that were experienced record lows in homicides now have significant spikes, and almost 30% of the cities have experienced spikes in homicides. So many of the issues can be tied to the COVID pandemic, which exacerbated unemployment rates, also the level of social isolation that many people in these communities are experiencing, the instability in the housing market, particularly those who have lost their jobs. And then we can't exclude the policing effect. So in light of what's happening in our nation, we're at least hearing anecdotally that many police departments, and specifically police officers, are engaging in policing that may not necessarily be proactive, because they may fear engaging in proactive policing because of the possibilities of indictment, and also the number of people that are carrying cell phones that are recording incidents and stops with the police, which has increased the level of distrust between the police and the community.
There are a lot of different types of violence, different circumstances that lead up to them. I know you focused a lot about violence among young men in big cities, including, as you mentioned, Baltimore. I assume there's not like a typical shooting, but are there common elements we should think about that end up leading to shootings, especially fatal shootings?
Well, what we're seeing now with many of the shootings is that they're of an interpersonal nature. And so the survivor or the victim of a homicide often knows the perpetrator. And in prior, during the late 80s and 90s, many of the homicides that we were experiencing in the cities across the U.S. were related to drug markets. Well, we're not really finding that right now, as much as these are more incidents of an interpersonal nature. So two people may know each other, an argument occurs, one person or even both of the individuals may have a gun, and the lack of being able to engage in conflict resolution, which then results in someone experiencing a non-fatal or fatality from those arguments. And then also, we have some anecdotal evidence, and we're working on this now in terms of researchers looking at what is the role of social media, because during COVID, we have so many restrictions that a lot of the the conflicts were playing out on social media. And so you may find one group or individuals that have conflict with each other, engaging in conflict over social media, and that ultimately plays out in the street.
Talking to Joseph Richardson from the University of Maryland, looking at increase in gun violence in the United States. We'll dig more into some of those interpersonal conflicts, and maybe if we could find stages, ways to prevent it from escalating in just a bit. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Now, though, Joe, I want to look at this plan from the White House. President Biden would create these strike forces to deal with illegal gun trafficking, step up enforcement on gun dealers. I want to give a listen to Attorney General Merrick Garland, some what he had to say.
ATF will initiate proceedings to revoke the licenses of dealers that willfully violate the law by failing to conduct required background checks, falsifying records, failing to respond to trace requests, refusing to permit ATF to conduct inspections, or transferring firearms to persons who are prohibited from owning them.
So, Joe, part of that is trying to get the flow of guns, I guess, illegally making their hands into people who are going to use them for violence. What do you think of what you're hearing from the White House there?
Well, I think it's quite admirable that the White House is now taking on interdiction and gun trafficking. But I have to be honest, there was an article that was published in May 26 in The Trace, which is a website that focuses on gun violence in the country. And what they found is that the ATF, in many instances, would be catching bad gun dealers across the country. But then for minor infractions or even infractions that required them to be shut down, they were often letting those gun dealers go. And so I would hope that with the new appointment of the new director of the ATF, we don't find a similar pattern of that kind of behavior with ATF agents across the country. And I'm optimistic that that will happen, but we definitely need interdiction efforts in the communities that are disproportionately affected by gun violence. But I would equally say as part of that bill includes gun violence intervention and prevention. And that's really at the heart of it, where we should be focusing a lot of our efforts on as well, because many of the programs that have been working in cities have been underfunded.
Let's talk about that. From what we know about how these conflicts are escalating, as you say, in person and on social media, do we have proven interventions that can stop them from escalating before they result in violence?
Sure. And I can name three. One would be the Cure Violence model, which was initiated and created by Dr. Gary Slutkin in Chicago, which uses a violence interruption model where individuals who have lived experiences being affected by violence as either victims or offenders or witnesses of it in the lived experience and cultural competence to engage in violence interruption, because they actually have the boots on the ground and understand the dynamics of the way conflict plays out in the street. Those violence interrupters have played a significant role in reducing violence in those neighborhoods when compared to neighborhoods that do not have Cure Violence interrupters. And that model treats violence as a disease, and the violence interrupters serve as a way of interrupting the transmission of gun violence as a disease. The second model would be hospital violence intervention programs, where patients who have been violently injured and are treated at hospitals are approached by staff who are trained to deal in violence intervention practices and provide psychosocial services in the form of cognitive behavioral therapy, group counseling, employment opportunities, housing, and legal assistance, to name a few. The hospital violence intervention programs, the primary aim is to reduce the level of trauma recidivism. And what studies have found is the trauma recidivism rate nationally can reach up to 60%, meaning that 6 out of every 10 persons that come into a hospital for a violent injury, this is not their first time in being hospitalized for injury. Some people have been hospitalized 2, 3, 4 times. And often the survivors of violent injury, because of their trauma, may, as a result of their traumatic stress, carry a firearm because they're fearful of being injured again. And so what these programs do is they provide psychosocial services and primarily in the form of mental health therapy to lower the trauma recidivism rate. And many studies that have been done on hospital violence intervention programs, and I'll just name three. One in Indianapolis found that the trauma recidivism rate was reduced from 8.7% to 0%. In Baltimore, the hospital violence intervention program there, the trauma recidivism rate among patients who enrolled in the program was 5% compared to the non-intervention group, which was 36%. And then another program in San Francisco, the trauma recidivism rate was reduced from 16.5 to 4.5. And I'll just give you my own personal and professional experiences. I am was the co-founder and founding director of a hospital violence intervention program at the University of Maryland Prince George's Hospital Center. And over a two-year period, when I served as the director from 2017 to 2019, we treated 116 patients in our program. And over that period, we only had one person return for a violent injury. And so if you do the math, that's less than 1% of a trauma recidivism rate. And as I said, the trauma recidivism rate can reach as high as 60%. And at that hospital, our trauma recidivism rate was 32%. And then the last program I would say is the Advanced Peace Model, which started in Richmond, California, which at one point had one of the highest homicide rates in the nation. And they used a focused deterrent strategy, focusing on a small population of young people who are more likely to engage in gun violence and may disproportionately represent the number of people who are engaged in firearm violence. And they targeted that population, provided them with wraparound services, a mentor, coaching, and in addition to subsidized employment, and found that the homicide rate was drastically reduced by using this focused deterrence approach. So those are three models that we can invest in that we know work because they've been evaluated through randomized controlled trials and are now evidence-based. And so we can use this $5 billion that the president has proposed and devote a lot of those resources to replicating these programs and funding programs that are already underfunded in cities that are experiencing gun violence.
We'll pick up our talk with Joe Richardson, chair of the African American Studies Department at the University of Maryland, researcher on gun violence and prevention strategies, looking at high numbers of shootings in communities around the country last year and this year, and what can be done to prevent that kind of violence. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question, an idea, a theory, or an experience to share. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Joe, I want to hear more about these hospital conversations because it sounds pretty intense to me. Somebody's come in, they've maybe been shot or otherwise a victim of violence. What kind of things happen in these conversations?
So typically when someone comes into the hospital and they've been violently injured, the first person who approaches them at bedside after they've been stabilized is a violence intervention specialist. And that person is someone who more than likely has the lived experience of being a survivor of violence as well, and may have been in the recent past a victim of violence who survived a violent injury and turned their lives around. So they clearly understand the experiences and trauma that that individual in lying in that bed is experiencing. And what we try to do is take advantage of what we call the golden hours. And those are the hours when a person who has been violently injured that may be involved in a high risk lifestyle is really reflecting upon how they arrived in this situation. And that you have an opportunity at that time to intercede and take advantage of their vulnerability in terms of thinking about how they can change their lives. And what we do is establish trust and rapport at bedside and get young people who have been injured involved in the resources and then engaging them in services, particularly mental health services, which for many young Black survivors of violent injury are often distrustful of the healthcare system. And we get them involved in psychosocial services. And typically, if your program works very well, it's been it, it ends up being quite effective. One of the things I would like to also emphasize is that there's also a cost component to it. The mean cost of a violent injury when in hospitalization is $50,000 and can reach up to, you know, $500,000 depending on the extent of the injury. And if you add criminal justice costs, you're also at $1 million. So you just have to think about the number of people who are non-fatally injured every year. And I'm not talking about homicides and the cost. And so what we found in the report from Everytown is that the cost of gun violence during the COVID pandemic and recession was $280 billion. Just put that into scale in terms of the $5 billion that's being proposed for gun violence intervention. And even in term, even though we consider that to be a great deal of money, the cost of gun violence is well exceeds the cost of prevention that we're that is currently being proposed by President Biden.
I should let people know there's a you have a docu-series called Life After the Gunshot. You and your colleagues working on this program. It's at the website lifeafterthegunshot.com. And some of the people who've been through these hospital conversations, Joe, after being injured, share their stories on this. Can you tell us a little bit about what it was like, what you heard from them, how they saw these conversations turning their lives around?
Yeah, so I would say these are 10 young men who were involved in our program, who decided and were courageous enough to tell their stories on camera about the ways that they experienced trauma, both pre and post their injuries. And again, what we found is that the traumatic stress and the symptoms that accompany it are not a rate specifically related to the violent injury, but are also a continuum of complex trauma that young people experience over the course of their lives. And so there is a concept called adverse childhood experiences, where if you experience some adverse trauma as a child and it goes undiagnosed and untreated, you're more likely to engage in high-risk behaviors as an adult. And so what we found is a continuum of trauma from very early on in the lives of many of the young men that we worked with. And again, is the reason why I emphasize engaging this population in a mental health therapy. But all of the young men that we worked with, only one of them out of the 10 returned to the hospital. And that was the one person out of the 116. And even that young man is doing very well today and also engaging in violence intervention efforts in his community. And so I would say that we need to think about the ways that structural violence leads to interpersonal violence. And in the documentary, what you'll find is we emphasize how structural violence plays out in the country as well. And those are factors that lead to interpersonal violence, such as living in a neighborhood with high concentrations of poverty, living in a neighborhood where there are food deserts and a lack of access to quality food, living in a neighborhood that has been affected by mass incarceration and hyper policing, which we have seen over the years in terms of the policing of Black and brown communities across this country. And so we also need to think about the ways that structural violence, which is preventable, leads to interpersonal violence among the young people that we work with. And so I'm really happy that we were able to get their stories out there through the platform. We're on episode one. We have three other episodes to go. The second episode will focus on the carceral state and policing in communities of color. And then we'll kind of wrap it up with episode four with healing solutions. And those solutions will be provided from the young people that we work with, because we think that the healing responses should actually come from the people that have been disproportionately impacted by violence and be a more bottom-up approach instead of a top-down approach.
Again, you can see those docu-series at lifeafterthegunshot.com. Joe, just a minute left. Do we need more research into the causes of gun violence and how to prevent it?
Clearly, and a great question. The fact that we're asking ourselves why gun violence has spiked and we don't really know why leads back to the lack of federal funding for gun violence research. And from 1996 up until 2020, the Dickey Amendment essentially prohibited the CDC and the NIH from providing gun violence research funding because it was framed as a form of gun control, right, and gun advocacy. So for 24 years, researchers like myself, we didn't have access to funding from the NIH or CDC to study gun violence research. And last year was the first year that the NIH and the CDC provided grants to conduct gun violence research, but that was at the tune of $25 million, which is essentially a drop in the bucket to engage in gun violence research if you really want the answers to why we're seeing such a spike. So I would advocate for all of your listeners to contact their senators and congressmen and women about increasing gun violence research funding through the federal government, because without adequate gun violence research, we'll still be having these conversations of why we think gun violence is happening and what we can do that which we know works and what doesn't work. And so it's vitally important that we invest federal dollars into understanding the causes and collateral consequences and solutions to gun violence research.
Joe, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Joseph Richardson is chair of the African American Studies Department at the University of Maryland, where he researches gun violence and gun violence prevention. He talked to us about continued high levels of gun violence around the country.